I'm Jason Pack, and this is Disorder, the podcast where we try to make sense of our mad world. I'm recording on Sunday, April 7th. Earlier today, there was an attack on a vessel 102 nautical miles southwest of Mukalla in Yemen. Yesterday, the UK Maritime Trade Organization said that a British vessel was attacked near Hudaydah off the coast of Yemen, and that the vessel and its crew were safe. And fascinatingly, the mainstream media and the big papers barely record this stuff anymore because it's been months that the Houthi militia group in Yemen are attacking a range of vessels transiting the Bab al-Mandib until the Suez Canal. The big, big news on this front happened a little over a month ago on March 2nd when the Ruby Mar sank in the Red Sea after drifting for several days. And this was really an eco-disaster. It released 21,000 metric tons of ammonium phosphate sulfate fertilizer into the waters. And that has implications as a greenhouse gas. It's unsafe. It's just a complete disaster. Local fishermen's livelihoods and complete marine ecosystems are going to be disrupted by this. So I thought it would be interesting to revisit this topic, but to go beyond just the impact that these attacks are having in the Red Sea and look at how do these things affect the global order? How are they affecting Arab diasporas in the West? How are they affecting the narrative war, which is happening in Gaza, in Yemen? And how is this all part and parcel of our age of disorder? To take aim at these new kinds of media narratives, and in fact, this new kind of marine terrorism, I am joined from Muscat, Oman by Laura Cretney. Laura is a Yemen expert and PhD candidate at the University of Durham. And she has spent the last decade working in international development. She's also a social entrepreneur and founder of Pink Gin, an online platform and marketing place focused on the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome, Laura. Ahlan wa sahlan fil disorder.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Where are we right now?
So to begin with, there are a few things that your listeners should know about the Houthis, Jason. The first is that they have evolved significantly as a movement and as a fighting force over the last 10 to 20 years. The second is that this is not a movement that deserves to be glorified in the way that it has been by many among the pro-Palestinian movement over the last few months. And the third is that the Houthis should not be underestimated. So the movement that we call the Houthis originates from a northern Yemeni tribe that today are represented by a political and military entity whose official name is Ansar Allah, which means party of God in Arabic, which today exerts authority far outside the territorial borders of their tribal heartland in the governorate of Saada in North Yemen. So they are technically Shia Muslim movement, which is often used as a very simplistic justification, particularly in the Western media, for their alliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran. However, while this is technically true, as you know, this doesn't quite capture the nuance of the Houthis' ideology or the pragmatism that's also largely driven their relationship with Iran. So the idea that the Houthis are aligned with Iran because they share a religious ideology is a little bit simplistic. However, over the last 10 years, the Houthi movement has been leaning closer ideologically to Iran, but this is actually more of a self-fulfilling prophecy that has arisen as a result of increased political and military cooperation, not just with Iran, but also with other Iran-aligned Shia groups in the region like Hezbollah. Now, the Houthis' military capability has also evolved significantly since they took over Sana'a in 2014. And the Houthis are considerably more powerful today than they were 10 years ago as a result of the conflict in Yemen. So what we're left with today is an ideologically fairly radical and really disproportionately powerful force that controls about a third of Yemeni territory and around 80% of the population in Yemen. Now, since the Houthis started attacking global shipping in the Red Sea in December, in what they claim is a response to the ongoing violence against Palestinians in Gaza, The movement has been glorified by many within the pro-Palestinian movement. We've seen posts on social media referring to Ansar Allah's actions as Yemen standing up to Israel and the Yemeni government taking action. We've seen pro-Palestine activists praising and glorifying the Houthis as the only Arab state standing up for Palestine. So overnight, the Houthis have been granted a legitimacy internationally that they never dreamed of. But it's really important for your listeners to know that, again, things are never that simple in the Middle East. The Houthis are well known to have committed various abuses and war crimes. So this is by no means a movement that should be glorified or underestimated. We're talking about a force that was not defeated by nearly 9 years of consistent airstrikes against them.
So I mentioned the sinking of the Ruby Mar, and you know, as we're talking, just this weekend, there's been these recent attacks that didn't sink any vessels. What has this meant for global shipping, Laura? How is this affecting everything?
So it's affecting the world in a lot of different ways. Commercially, the effects are pretty well documented. You know, we know very well that a large amount of global shipping passes through the Red Sea. Ships have been forced to change routes. It's costly. There are delays. The prices are being passed on to consumers. Politically, also, this is squeezing Western governments who are already under pressure domestically and internationally due to Israel's onslaught in Gaza. But I think a really, really interesting and much less debated aspect of this is actually this really dangerous precedent that the Houthis are setting, perhaps completely unintentionally, we don't know, of using not only the economy as leverage through control over these shipping routes, but also the environment. So as you mentioned, the Ruby Mar sank in March after drifting for several days, releasing 21,000 metric tons of ammonium phosphate sulfate fertilizer into the ocean, which spells an ecological disaster for the region. Now, just to put that into context, it was a similar substance, ammonium nitrate, which caused the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut in 2020. This could potentially devastate marine life, destroy coral reefs, sea life, and jeopardize hundreds of thousands of jobs in the shipping industry, as well as cutting off potentially some of these communities along the coast from their supplies of food and fuel. Even the salvage companies that would normally go and recover vessels like this are reluctant to go in and deal with this because they too risk being targeted by Houthi missiles, and they have a duty of care for their crew. It's also a reminder of the FSO Safir debacle, which was a supertanker that was moored and decaying in the Red Sea near the port of Hodeidah, carrying over 1 million barrels of oil until recently when a rescue mission finally emptied it of the oil that was on board. And this vessel had been sitting there for years at risk of leaking due to erosion, falling apart, or even exploding, which would have released all of that oil into the ocean, killing huge quantities of fish, which would have cost hundreds of thousands of Yemenis their livelihoods, caused irreversible damage to marine life, coral reefs, mangroves. Now, for years, the UN was trying to coordinate a mission to empty the vessel, but the Houthis were effectively holding it hostage, continuing to add impediments to the process and using it for leverage in the conflict in Yemen and the ongoing political negotiations. But it's also potentially causing a risk to things like undersea carbon storage facilities and even critical communications infrastructure like telecom wires. So I'm sure that you've seen back in February, these three telecoms cables under the Red Sea were cut, reportedly affecting 25% of the traffic flowing through the Red Sea. Now, this Red Sea telecoms route is crucial for data moving from Asia to Europe. And some of this traffic had to be rerouted as a result of these wires being cut. Now, no one really knows what happened. The government blames the Houthis blame the UK and the US. But regardless, this highlights a clear vulnerability and potential threat to global security.
Wow. So we've got a disordering actor here, doesn't care about the fact that holding a vessel hostage or doing this marine terrorism harms their people, the Yemenis' livelihoods in the fishing industry, but would rather cut off the nose to spite the face to hold the world to hostage. This is exactly the kind of negative feedback loops and disorderers versus orderers that I'm really interested in digging deep into. What I want to know, Laura, is has the Houthis holding the entire world hostage meaningfully affected the way that the war has played out in Gaza? And then have other attempts to, you know, hold the Red Sea hostage affected how Saudi and the West have dealt with the Houthis?
So I think it's really important to clarify that there are two different questions that need answering here. So one is, are the Houthi strikes having an impact on the situation in Gaza? And the other is, are the Houthi strikes achieving their goals? And I think people often fail to separate the two. Now, are the strikes influencing the situation in Gaza? It's very difficult to say. I mean, up until recently, I would have said not really, no. You know, the Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping, yes, they have massively disrupted international trade by affecting cargo traffic between Europe and Asia, increasing shipping times, costs. And yes, this has put pressure on Western governments to deter Israel and to hold the Israeli government accountable. But has this actually had an impact on the ground until now? It's very difficult to say. And unless you're inside Netanyahu's head, I think it's very, very difficult to say what is influencing his decision-making process there as well. So let's turn to this question of whether the Houthi attacks are achieving their goals. Now, of course, I'm making assumptions about the real motivations of the Houthi leadership, but I would be much more inclined to answer yes to this question because the Houthis are benefiting enormously from their actions in the Red Sea and the Western response. Firstly, it's a very low-cost strategy for the Houthis. It's easy. You know, they're not using particularly sophisticated weaponry. They're just leveraging their geographical position. And that's something that their adversaries can't change without removing them from power, which the last decade has shown. You're not going to do that, at least not just with airstrikes. Now, their confrontation with the US now strengthens their domestic position and gives them increased popularity and legitimacy. We have to remember as well, the Houthis are a wartime government. They have governed successfully during wartime, but there are major questions around whether they can govern successfully during peacetime. So they have a lot to gain from sustaining the conflict, which is essentially what they're doing through these strikes and through the counterattacks from the UK and the US. This is strengthening their political hand. It's demonstrating their power. They might even have surprised themselves by how much power they have in this situation because of everything that we've just discussed. This has been a huge boost to their legitimacy. So clearly, this is massively benefiting the Houthis. And I would say that their motivations are not necessarily exclusively political, but also ideological. They're obviously a very ideologically motivated movement. So they're showing solidarity and consistency here with their stated mission. But I don't know that it's really saved very many lives in Gaza so far.
This gets at a key point about how I see the enduring disorder, which is that a disorderer is going to disorder because disordering helps the disorderer stay in power. So if you're the Houthis, it's not super important whether or not your attacks have actually altered Netanyahu's calculus, but keeping that state of war going on and making sure that your attacks are covered and the Houthis are in the media and all of that helps the disorderer keep things disordered so it can have a wartime government and stay in power. And this is the essence of how this disordering strategy is connected to media narratives. And I know you've done a lot of research on the question of narratives, Laura. So how do the actual actions of the disorder on the military tactical level play out onto this other realm of conflict, which is the narrative level?
Well, I think as we've seen, the Houthis have massively benefited from the narratives that have been created around what they're doing. First of all, this taps into part of their core mission. You know, they have these very inflammatory statements, death to America, death to Israel. But this is the first time that they've really been able to show that they are acting on that. This is the first time really that they are in direct conflict with the West. So in that sense, it's bringing that narrative to life. And we've also seen a really interesting aspect of this has been the role of the Palestinian movement and the narratives, the pro-Palestine narratives, which the Palestinian diaspora has a lot to do with the generation and dissemination of these narratives around the world. What this has done to boost the Houthis' legitimacy, the Houthis have come out here as the heroes of the Palestinians, standing up for Gazans when nobody else is. And the Houthis should not be glorified in this way. They clearly have no regard for human rights. They have been well documented to have committed human rights abuses against journalists, against women. They have been committing war crimes systematically through the recruitment of child soldiers, which is also, you know, laying the foundations for future generations and future cycles of conflict in Yemen. And yet these narratives are so easily disseminated and so convincing, particularly in our connected online world today. We're living in a world where people don't want to understand the nuances of a situation if it means that they have to sit and spend hours reading and learning and understanding historical context and political intricacies. They want to see a 30-second soundbite which taps into how they feel. So, for example, you've seen these news clips and these sound bites saying things like, forget about your Amazon packages, Palestinians are dying, and presenting the Houthis as the heroes, which is actually not accurate and playing into their hand. And I think if we want to understand this some more and exactly the implications of this, it's maybe worth going back to the conflict in Yemen and having a quick recap of where we are with the situation today. Now, the sad truth is that in October, Yemen was closer than it had been in a decade to achieving peace. And the events in the region since, and fundamentally these narratives around what the Houthis are doing, have totally altered the balance of power in Yemen. So there's currently no official peace agreement in Yemen, whether between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, nor between the various political and military factions that continue to vie for control across the country. However, there has been a sort of de facto stalemate on the ground across much of the country, although it has remained deeply divided along political and regional lines. So the economic and humanitarian situations have remained dire and in desperate need of a peace process. But the last year or so, pre-October 7th, Yemen actually came closer than it had done throughout the last 9 years of conflict to reaching some kind of a political settlement, which would have given the country a much needed chance at peace. Not a perfect opportunity or a guaranteed path, but the best chance and the most hope that Yemenis have had since 2015. The October 7th Hamas attack, the brutal Israeli aggression against Gaza, and the Houthi attacks on shipping and the narratives that have emerged around this have completely halted that settlement in its tracks because the reality on the ground has changed. And that is largely to do with these narratives. So the Houthis are now in a completely different position than they were back in October. The situation in Gaza and the attacks on shipping have massively strengthened their hand and essentially raised the price of a political process and reduced their incentive to compromise. Now, of course, at the same time, this has been complicated by the US redesignating the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which has fundamentally complicated one of the key issues that was acting as a barrier to peace in Yemen, which was the payment of government salaries in Houthi-controlled areas. So the Houthis have been demanding, as one of their conditions for peace, that the government of Yemen, or in reality Saudi Arabia, should pay the salaries of government employees in northern Houthi-controlled areas. The government of Yemen and Saudi had understandably been pushing back against this because they saw this as them effectively paying the salaries of the Houthis' employees and even their fighters. However, it was widely understood that the Houthis in Saudi Arabia had finally reached some kind of an agreement on the payment of salaries back in October. But, of course, now the sanctions that come with the designation of the Houthis or redesignation of the Houthis as a terrorist organization now make those payments extremely complicated, if not impossible. So what this whole situation has done is it's taken the pressure off the Houthis to negotiate and reach a settlement. It's allowing them to perpetuate the conflict and maintain their role as a wartime government. And I want to be clear, the Houthis never really wanted a political settlement. They didn't really want to compromise. They want to prolong the conflict because they believe that they can continue to strengthen their hand by continuing to fight, by continuing to take more territory, particularly in key governorates like Ma'arib and Shabwa, which are rich in natural resources. And if they succeed in this, then this alters the balance of power even further and further weakens the position of Saudi Arabia and the so-called internationally recognized government. So unfortunately, after what looked like a relatively promising situation just 6 months ago, thanks to these narratives glorifying the Houthis' actions, which have built their legitimacy and their popularity, and the failure of Western diplomacy in the region, prospects for peace in Yemen now appear as distant as they've ever been.
What a tragic story. If I could sum up, because this is extremely nuanced and complicated, for a range of reasons, the Saudis and Emiratis were unable to win the war in Yemen and install the government they wanted. They committed lots of human rights abuses there. The Houthis held on, but we were getting close, potentially having to do maybe with the China-led Saudi-Iran normalization, potentially having to do with other changes in global geopolitics, to some kind of Saudi-Houthi-US deal. And the war in Gaza, the glorification of the Houthis, now we're further away from peace in Yemen. And the disorderer Houthis are able to extract a greater price for them to compromise. And the Palestinian cause has kind of been instrumentalized here because it's not like the Houthis have the ability to get aid into Palestine or are really helping Gazans. All very worrying. And what I want to pivot to is the question of narrative, and then what about a further regional escalation? So there have been some Israeli attacks in the Baalbek and Bekaa Valley areas in northern Lebanon. People are saying that if there's an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, there may be a pivot to the war in the north. What about a larger regional conflagration? Where does that stand? Will Yemen also slip into a new phase of war then?
I think it's very possible where we are now. I think at this point, nobody really knows what a regional war would look like. But what this does do is this highlights how interconnected these dynamics in the region are. And it also highlights the way that international diplomacy has failed to grasp this. It highlights the way that diplomacy is shifting in the region. It highlights the West's failures. It highlights the way that regional states are starting to hedge their bets and do their own diplomacy as opposed to relying on the West to guarantee their security. Particularly for America, this really shows a lack of a clear or at least a strategically rooted policy towards the region and certainly towards Yemen. The redesignation of the Houthis as a terrorist organization is a perfect example of that. So both Biden and Trump have blundered with this, and all because of domestic pressure and political posturing, which I think also shows how the strategic rationale affecting foreign policy is changing at the moment. So Trump designated the Houthis a terrorist organization for his own political reasons, which worsened the humanitarian situation. Biden undesignated them as a slapback at Trump, which completely wasted an opportunity for leverage in the peace process. And now Biden has redesignated them again to look like he's doing something which threatens the humanitarian situation and the peace process, and really does very little to restrain the Houthis themselves. So this is showing how diplomacy in the Middle East is really failing. And often these politicians, particularly in the West, are making very short-term calculations based on their own domestic concerns. This also highlights, as you said, how interconnected these dynamics are in the region and how diplomacy in the region should really be taking a more holistic and regional approach. You can't put any conflict in a box. You know, you can't just deal with these things unilaterally. They do spill over and require careful management that requires also a deep knowledge of history and local dynamics and takes into account the region as a whole.
After the break, please come back as we try to order the disorder. So, Laura, you've pointed out a lot of the complexities which are facing Western policymakers. In other words, we have a policy instrument, we use it, but it doesn't have the effect we want. And then there are domestic pressures to be seen to be doing something, but no one knows if it actually accomplishes anything. So order the disorder with me. What can we actually do? And we, meaning not only Western policymakers, but individuals, the international community, our allied Arab states like Egypt and Saudi and Qatar, what can be done?
Okay, so first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that what's being done right now is not working. So the aim of the US and UK strikes against the Houthis is deterrence. So the logic is, as far as I understand it, that by degrading the Houthis' military capacity, this will deter the Houthis to cease their strikes. This is clearly not working. The Houthis have actually expanded their attacks since the Western airstrikes began. They've expanded them in number, in the kinds of attacks, the kinds of vessels they're targeting, and they've even expanded them geographically. And the situation, as we've discussed, is creating all of these secondary consequences. So it's boosting the Houthis' legitimacy, strengthening their political hand, perpetuating conflict in Yemen, creating continued economic instability, environmental damage. So I think we can very clearly see that it's not working. In fact, it kind of baffles me that anybody thought that this would succeed. The Houthis have a history of resilience and adaptation. They fought 6 wars in Sa'adah against the Yemeni government. They survived 8 years of coalition airstrikes. And they came out the other side stronger and even more resilient. So no one's trying anything new. And we're still looking to the old powers and institutions that were once seen as the providers of security. And there's very little faith left in them at this point. So there's one thing that I would like to see the international community investing more energy and resources in, and that's leveraging the power of diasporas for peace building and development. Now, I'm a little biased because this is the subject of my research, but we're living in an age of diaspora. People are migrating like never before, but they're also more connected than they ever have been, not just to their homeland, but also to identity groups, communities, ideas, and causes that are often transnational and cross-border in nature. And these are sustained as well, as we've discussed, by these powerful narratives. And this can be really important for domestic politics because diasporas can represent key demographics and constituencies in elections. But diasporas can also play a really important role in conflict in their homeland. They can be engaged or mobilized in homeland conflicts in a number of different ways, whether it's through finance, humanitarian efforts, development activities, and then, of course, advocacy, peace building, human rights and transitional justice, and lobbying and influencing foreign policy of host states and rallying support for particular causes, conflict parties, and narratives. And we're seeing this, of course, at the moment in the case of the Palestinian diaspora, which is truly international. There's Palestinian communities all over the world that are connected by this cause, and their narratives are still reaching thanks to the internet and thanks to social media. You know, cultural production and storytelling is all happening online now. So diaspora is a hugely powerful, transnational, often highly political and politicized communities. They are going to play a role in these regional conflicts, whether we like it or not. And that role can be positive or negative.
I hear you. It's really important to acknowledge the realities as they are rather than as we want them to be, right? And one of those realities is that in non-major powers, meaning the medium powers, it's the diasporas who are going to push various issues so that the Palestinian and Arab and Jewish communities are pushing British policy in different ways rather than Britain's ability to say, decisively affect British interests in Israel-Palestine. 100% agree. But I don't really grasp, once we acknowledge that reality, how can the diaspora play a role in the Yemen conflict?
So the diaspora are playing a role in the Yemen conflict already in a number of different ways, whether it's through fundraising, either for particular conflict parties or even financing entire communities in the absence of government structures, in the absence of NGOs or, you know, humanitarian organizations able to play a role. They're also engaged in things like political advocacy and lobbying. So they're lobbying their domestic governments. And you see this in really powerful ways in places like Dearborn in Michigan, which is home to a huge Yemeni community, a very big Arab community. And this is, of course, a swing state in the U.S. election. So that's just to highlight the power that diasporas can play domestically, as well as the power that they can play in the homeland through finance.
Yeah, but they're not actually having any positive role. They're just threatening to not vote for Biden. A lot of us who are on the left are very angry at the Michigan Arabs for being so unbelievably unconstructive. In other words, I see their role as negative as the Houthis doing marine terrorism, because by threatening to not vote for Biden, they're merely just potentially bringing into being a much worse situation by helping Trump get elected, who will have a policy which is infinitely worse for the humanitarian and structural issues in the region.
Exactly. But what is the U.S. government actually doing to engage those diaspora communities, whether through consultation with them to understand their perspective and also to understand the influence that they can have in terms of shaping narratives that affect both the vote at home and the narrative on the ground in the homeland? How can diasporas who are clearly playing a role, positive or negative, whether we like it or not, how can they be leveraged so that that role can be more constructive? You know, instead of throwing resources behind airstrikes that aren't working, why aren't we throwing resources behind including diasporas in political negotiations, in development activities? Not only do we benefit from their access and their understanding of the context on the ground, but you're also giving these angry and disaffected communities a sense of purpose and a sense that they're contributing to something positive for their homeland.
We're going to have to disagree agreeably, because in the U.S., as opposed to in Britain, because the U.S. is still the world's sole superpower and hegemonic orderer, we don't have a consultation with the U.S. population about foreign policy goals. Do you know what I mean? I absolutely oppose the idea that before the U.S. calculates a foreign policy response, some kind of mini referendum should be done with the U.S. population or with constituencies. That's exactly what we shouldn't do, because that's going to lead to the Jewish community wanting one thing, the Yemenis wanting this, the Palestinian diaspora having a slightly different view than the Yemeni diaspora. That's exactly the opposite of ordering, because that's allowing multiple power centers. Well, what we need, particularly in hegemonic ordering, is just the top table. Don't consult public opinion. Don't consult what's happened before. Don't think about the election. Think hyper long term. Think about how to work with our allies and solve the collective action problems.
I'm more suggesting that diasporas could be engaged, for example, at the level of track 2 and track 3 in conflict resolution and peace building processes. It doesn't need to be that you set up some new kind of consultation at the highest levels of politics and power in the US. What about multilateral institutions? What about organizations within government that are already doing things, whether it's within local communities, whether it's, you know, the EU, the UN that are funding peace building and development programs in Yemen? How can diasporas be included more effectively so that we're benefiting from their knowledge, benefiting from their connections to populations on the ground, and also making them feel included and making them feel like they're contributing something positive to their homeland?
The problem, to my mind, with U.S. policy is it's been pulled by domestic considerations, that it's an election year, the issue of potentially Biden being afraid of losing some Jewish mega donors, then his being afraid that some Arab-leaning and left-leaning constituencies might sit out the election. That is what's leading to policy incoherence. The diaspora, to my mind, in the States is over-consulted. Well, what we need is actual leadership. In other words, Biden to say, this is a complete humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but the Israelis have a right to defend themselves. I've set a very precise red line. When Netanyahu goes beyond it, it's not only that we're not giving any more armaments, we're doing X and Y and Z and blah, 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 blah. But until that red line, our policy is this, and we've gotten all the Europeans on board. In other words, there's no clarity of what the hegemonic ordering needs to be. And I don't see how diaspora can play a role in this.
Well, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head in that nobody is doing that. That's not happening. We're not seeing it. People aren't doing anything new. So including diaspora, this is something that's already happening, but it's a case of how can we increase the effectiveness of that in things like peace building and development processes, which is what I'm addressing specifically here.
Okay, walk me through it. What would it involve in terms of dealing with the Yemeni community in Michigan? Because I'm the first one who's open to being educated, so maybe I'm missing something.
So, for example, the UN has had various programs over the years around track 2 and track 3 political process in Yemen, and trying to make those processes inclusive, trying to make sure that they're represented by Yemeni women, by Yemeni youth, and to an extent by the Yemeni diaspora. So how can you really leverage those diaspora voices from these key communities, not just for the influence that they can play on their host state's domestic politics, but also on the way, the influence that they're having already in their local communities in Yemen through, for example, financing humanitarian initiatives. Often these individuals and communities are a wealth of knowledge of local dynamics of these conflicts, which are often overlooked at the higher level, political level.
Yes. Of course, if we could take the expertise in these diasporas and marshal it for good to inform not only Western but regional policies so that there is more knowledge rather than more anger and shouting on the internet and non-constructive protests in certain forms, of course, I'm all for that. What I'm worried about is what I see happening, particularly in the US, is that the Biden administration has lacked strategic vision and that hegemonic leadership is really laying out your red lines and enforcing them. I see Biden almost falling into a trap not so dissimilar to Obama with the Syria red line. And I want to back up so listeners can see a parallel here. Obama said if chemical weapons were used by Assad in Syria, there would be serious consequences, which implied that somehow Assad regime assets would be bombed if chemical weapons were deployed. Then chemical weapons were deployed. He didn't do anything. He said, oh, maybe the British need to have this vote in the House of Commons. For a whole range of domestic reasons in the UK, that vote went against action. Then in America, they decided to do no action. This was allowing the Syrian civil war to spiral completely out of control because we got caught articulating a red line that we didn't enforce. And then Russia doubled and tripled down on their intervention and essentially won the war in Syria for the Assads. What I see potentially happening with Biden and the West in general on Israel is they're saying to Netanyahu, Netanyahu, you've been a very naughty boy. We said, don't kill the aid workers. We said, no famine. Oh, you did a famine. We're going to be really changing our policy. And then not enough policy changes. There's some talk and some scolding, but either the weapons continue to flow or there's been seeming to be no meaningful policy changes that really affect things on the ground. The Israelis have their own strategic calculus for why they're doing what they're doing. It's not like real leadership has been shown by the West or Biden in any way guiding the Israeli response. So I'm very, very worried that the issue is not about more domestic inclusion or more expertise into the process, but simply a lack of leadership and, for lack of a better term, moral clarity on behalf of the international community in general in dealing with both supporters of Hamas and supporters of the Palestinian, and particularly in dealing with Netanyahu.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, at the level of the public, there's less expectation to hold, you know, that governments should be exerting that kind of leadership. I think the Trump years have massively degraded the public's expectation of the U.S. government to hold anybody accountable for things like war crimes and human rights abuses. And I think that this is only furthering that.
Yeah, because if the U.S. does these war crimes and we essentially have insurrections and violation of the law and stuff in our own country, how can we even possibly be thought to order the world abroad, right?
Exactly. And I just don't think that, certainly for the left, Trump was looked on as any kind of a moral president. And I don't think that at the moment, with everything that's happening in Gaza, I don't think that people are expecting anything of the such from Biden either.
So if we step back, I am completely of the view that the State Department and the FCDO can benefit from the expertise that exists in our societies. And that there are going to be some Yemeni American and Yemeni British graduate students who should be called into Whitehall and Foggy Bottom to share that expertise, right?
Yeah.
But are you also suggesting that we should be working with certain influencers in the Yemeni diasporic and Palestinian diasporic communities to, rather than just foreground voices that shout, foreground, hey, here's a way you can constructively help by donating to this charity or sponsoring this Gazan who can, you know, seek asylum, and maybe proposing certain policies that are in the middle and then leverage the existing media and diasporic networks?
This is already happening, Jason. It's a case of whether the government wants to actually leverage this or not. The vast majority of the fundraisers, of the campaigns that I'm seeing online, are coming from the diaspora. The diaspora is organized anyway. It's a case of of whether our governments and our international institutions are actually leveraging that positively or are just prepared to let that go in a direction that they have no control over.
Okay, I think I'm understanding you a little bit better. We may have a slight nuance in our views and approach, but if you could hit us with one thing that the UK government should do concretely on this topic, what should it be? How should they order?
I think that the UK should engage diaspora more constructively in ongoing development efforts because there's a lot of money being put into development initiatives and also a lot of money goes towards humanitarian emergencies. How can you engage the diaspora in those processes so that they also see from a PR perspective, you know, they see positive things that the government are doing?
From your mouth to Biden, Sunak, Blinken, and Lord Cameron's ears, Laura. You presented a lot of interesting and creative ways to engage stakeholders and to try to order the disorder. Thank you for joining the program. Our producer has been, as always, George McDonough. Our executive producer is Neil Fearn. If you'd like to find out more about this topic, and there's a lot to find out about this topic, it's so complicated and a lot of things have been happening in terms of the marine terrorism and other ways in which the global economy has been affected, we have curated a really interesting series of links in the show notes. And if you want to delve yet deeper, please follow our Substack, which the link is in the show notes. You can follow the Substack. And I'm going to be writing some stuff about Yemen and drawing on all of the insights that Laura has shared with us and helped me learn. So the world might seem really disordered out there, but I hope we brought a tiny semblance of order to your thinking about these issues, and I'm wishing you a very orderly week.